Good morning. The Early Learning and Elementary Education Subcommittee will now come to order. Kirsten, please call the roll.
Chair Lupus.
Here.
Vice Chair Fetterhoff is excused. Ranking Member Davis.
Here.
Representative Cheney.
Here.
Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Hunchowski.
Here.
Representative Koster.
Here.
Representative Lamarca.
Here.
Representative Learned.
Here.
Representative McCurdy.
Here.
Representative McFarland.
Here.
Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Nixon.
Here.
Representative Roach.
Present.
Representative Rodriguez.
Present.
Representative Trabulski is excused. Representative Trunau.
Here.
Representative Williams.
Here.
Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Kirsten. Members, please remember to silence all electronic devices, a mistake I made yesterday. Be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters. And please remember just to push your microphone button as the green light will indicate that it is live. Members, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Early Learning and Elementary Education Subcommittee. Normally at our first meeting, members, we would do introductions, but given the limited amount of time we have and the importance of this work, we're going to get started immediately. And if we have time at the end, we will do introductions. But before we begin, I want to note that, to my knowledge, this is the first time in the history of our legislative body that we have a committee that is explicitly focused on the earliest years in children's lives. No doubt there is an overwhelming and growing body of research that speaks the importance of ensuring that all children are able to build a strong foundation upon which they enter the K-12 system. And as someone who has worked in this arena for more than a decade, I cannot begin to express my appreciation and gratitude to Speaker Sprouse and Chairman Latvala for prioritizing these issues and allowing us the opportunity to propose and debate policies that will give all children in Florida a strong start in school and in life. And I am truly honored to serve as your chair alongside two close friends and colleagues, Vice Chair Elizabeth Fetterhoff and Ranking Member Davis, both individuals who are passionate about these issues and their impact on the future of Florida. You know, members, our appointment to the subcommittee comes at a critical moment. You know, issues that have historically been challenging have been exacerbated by the pandemic through school closures, through a digital divide, and through challenges with learning at home. So we have to ask ourselves two questions. One, how do we reverse learning loss? And two, how do we continue to close the achievement gap, a gap that I fear has no doubt increased over the last year? And members, the answer to both questions is to focus on the first tool students need for lifelong learning, reading. You know, there's simply no question regarding the correlation between literacy and both educational attainment and lifelong earning potential. And as I see it, there are three key areas where we can begin today. First, we must ensure that our teachers have the skills and resources necessary to effectively ensure children are learning to read, and then more importantly, reading to learn. Secondly, we need to ensure access to books at home and create word-rich environments for all of our children. And third, and most importantly, always remembering that a parent is a child's first teacher by supporting parental engagement through effective and appropriate means. But members, unfortunately, many teachers still do not have the necessary training and resources needed to teach their students reading effectively, and far too many parents do not have the resources to support reading at home. And this all bears out in the statistics. While Florida has made remarkable progress in K-12 achievement over the last 20 years, we still have 42% of our third graders who are not reading at grade level. I want you to hear those numbers, 42% of our third graders who are not reading at grade level. And those were numbers prior to the pandemic. So members, today we are joined by experts on the science of reading and early literacy to discuss how early learning providers, schools, parents, communities, and teachers can meet today's challenges and provide for a better future through reading. So members, our first presenter today is Dr. Kimiona Burke, who is the Policy Director for Early Education at the Foundation for Excellence in Education. She's a former teacher and later served as the State Literacy Director at the Mississippi Department of Education. Dr. Burke will provide a historical overview of the science of reading and its importance to improving the literacy skills of students from all backgrounds. She will also outline potential next steps for implementing science-based reading instruction statewide in Florida. Members, please, we're going to allow Dr. Burke to present, and then at the end we will be able to ask her questions. So Dr. Burke, you are recognized to begin your presentation.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Okay, being able to read gives students across our country access to the world. This alone motivates educators to go above and beyond to reach their students and to teach them how to read. But reading is not just an education issue, it's also an economic issue. 88% of students who failed to earn a diploma were struggling readers in third grade. And students who are not reading proficiently in third grade are first, four times more likely to not graduate high school. If African-American or Hispanic, students are six times more likely to drop out or fail to graduate from high school. And if low-income minority, these students are eight times more likely to drop out or fail to graduate from high school. So why is the topic of high school dropouts important? High school dropouts are not eligible for about 90% of the jobs in our economy, have yearly earnings that are less than 50% of someone who earns a bachelor's degree, and make up nearly 50% of all heads of households on welfare. I believe you received pre-reading materials with the definition of the science of reading and links to articles or podcasts that were written and interviewed by Emily Hanford that detailed the impact of being taught to read with the science of reading instruction. So I will be speaking from that context today. Across the country, many states, many legislators are and state education agencies are either working on developing, improving, implementing, and even just beginning the discussions around ways to improve literacy outcomes in their respective states. So what are the most recent forces behind this reading policy momentum? The science of reading, which you may have also heard being described as structured literacy, it places a focus on the teaching the five components of reading that were determined by the National Reading Panel in early 2000, that these are the components that are needed to ensure that students become proficient readers. There are phonemic awareness, or knowing the sounds, letters, phonics, being able to match those letters to sounds. Fluency, where students are able to read automatically with expression, vocabulary, knowing the words, what they mean, and then also comprehension, the goal of reading. So this method of instruction, it has been proven, research spans decades, and so it's been proven to provide students with foundational skills that they need to learn to read, even those with reading difficulties, such as students with dyslexia. There's also been a recent push for dyslexia-focused reform. So parents and teachers across the country are learning more about dyslexia and other reading challenges, and they are leading efforts to ensure that teachers can not only identify dyslexia characteristics in their children and students, but also be able to provide the appropriate instruction needed and also those interventions that are needed. So how can we reach all students? This slide, the information was compiled by Nancy Young from a number of studies, and it shows the ladder of reading. So if you look at the top two boxes, they speak to about 40% of our students who are already in literacy-rich environments and who will likely learn to read no matter how you teach them. But over 60% of our students, more than half of students, will need that explicit instruction in how written language works. They will need to unlock the code to reading. So they need the structured literacy approach that includes that explicit, systematic instruction. And in the words of Emily Hanford, all kids will benefit from being taught how their written language works. So this model is considered the simple view of reading, and it represents the skills that students need to comprehend. So what goes into teaching students how to read? It's an age-old question. What do you need to do? What skills do students need to have in order to learn to read? I want you to note that reading comprehension is the product of word recognition and language comprehension, not the sum. And the product means that you have to have both word recognition and language comprehension to get to reading comprehension, not just a little bit of each. So with word recognition or decoding, I'm sure you've heard a lot about the science of reading being related to phonics. So phonics is just one part. So word recognition and decoding is students' ability to transform the print into spoken language. That includes our phonics and our phonological awareness. They can sound out words. Language comprehension is equally important, and it's students' ability to understand spoken language. So when you are speaking to children, they understand what you're saying. When they're reading, they understand what is being read. There are some students that may come to school with language comprehension skills. They've been talked to, they have a literacy rich environment in their home. So they come with some of these skills. So there has been a focus on making sure that not just the language comprehension is present, but also the ability to decode those words once they see them in print. So Florida's initial education reform began in the late 90s, early 2000s, with funding from Reading First, and included strategies and coordinated efforts to improve literacy outcomes. And when Florida implemented its comprehensive literacy policy, there was funding and there were immediate and consistent gains. So in addition to the funding, there was a coordinated and strategic effort to ensure that literacy outcomes were the focus, and there was a commitment to improving literacy outcomes for Florida students. Mississippi implemented a similar policy, almost identical to Florida, in 2013. And we have seen similar, very early results. Since 2013, we have made at least a 10-point gain on our NAEP, which is our National Assessment of Educational Progress. And so we know that this policy works. But what I want to bring your attention to with this slide is that Florida is now in 2019 at 225 with a scale score for their average or fourth grade students, but they are now performing around the same as they were in 2007, 2009. So today, I wanna speak just a little bit about ways in which we can refocus and also recommit to the best practices that were included that gave Florida its early gains when they implemented their literacy policy years ago. So what is the state of state? So I talked about a comprehensive policy and these best practices. So let's look at what Florida has in place or plans to put in place as a result of CARES Act funding. The first step is to adopt a comprehensive third grade reading policy, which Florida has done. The next component speaks to professional development and job embedded coaching. We can't just say to teachers, you know, go forth and teach students how to read, right? We have to build teacher knowledge. We have to create this common language for reading instruction through professional development that's grounded in the science of reading. And then also to support teachers in the classroom and that transfer from theory, that professional development, to actual practice, standing in front of students and teaching them with the science of reading instruction. Regional literacy directors and on-site literacy coaches are there to support teachers in their efforts. Next, K-3 assessment system and support for families. We have to gather baseline data. We have to know where students are so we will know how to address any deficiencies that they have and to be able to progress monitor to make sure that what we're doing is actually working. So to develop a progress monitoring plan that identifies those students and also provides those intensive interventions. And then also, our parents are our partners, ensuring that we're providing supports and resources for parents to support literacy at home. And lastly, the retention component. This piece is for students who are severely below grade level and do not qualify for one of the good cause exemptions. These students, although they will be experiencing third grade for a second time, there has to be an intentional effort to ensure that these students receive more intensive interventions and that we are continuing to progress monitor and to change practice and change interventions when these practices may not be working. So if you're looking at the areas that are highlighted in possibly lighter blue, I want to bring your attention to the fact that these are efforts that are now underway and will be funded with CARES Act funds. We all know that CARES Act funding is available for 2 years. So our goal will be to ask ourselves the question, how do we ensure that these best practices become ingrained in our practices and what we're continuing to do the way forward in Florida? These were practices that were put into place before with the earlier funding from Reading First. But of course, as you know, when funding goes away, a lot of the efforts, the implementation pieces, they go away as well. So now we have a unique opportunity to bring these strong practices back. But we want to ensure that you are aware that these practices will be funded through CARES Act funds. So how do we close the learning and opportunity gaps for all students? And I want to spend just a few minutes speaking to the potential impact of COVID-19 on learning loss. And I know that we are all concerned about how this has impacted our children, our students. I'm a mom of a freshman high school student. So one thing that we know for sure is that we don't know the full impact of the learning loss at this moment. We also know that there are several factors that contribute to more significant learning loss for some of our students, some of our groups, especially those who are vulnerable to the impact of the pandemic, such as our students who have been impacted by the digital divide. They have a lack of support at home, and it may be because their parents are working, or their siblings are working, or they don't have that support for someone to guide their learning or hold them accountable for homework and other assignments while they're at home. Students who have not attended classes virtually or traditionally, they haven't attended consistently, and we know from all of the articles that have been released that there are millions of students who are still considered missing, meaning they were registered last school year but have not registered for school this academic year. So we have to make sure that we are finding these students. And then also the quality of instruction. We know that that has varied greatly across our districts and our states, and our teachers are amazing and resilient. But for many of them, this transition to virtual learning has been challenging. So we wanna make sure that we're supporting teachers in every way possible. And to understand the impact of this pandemic or COVID-19, we have to administer assessments to collect data and then to target our support, whether it's teachers targeting their support in the classrooms or state education agency leaders who are targeting and coordinating their support from the state level. So the other pieces of this work, including the boots on the ground efforts to train and support teachers and engage families, will also serve as key levers to meet students where they are and to get them to proficiency. And so what we do know is that this policy works with the right support, with the science of reading, and Florida and Mississippi have the data to prove it. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Burke. Members, do you have questions for Dr. Burke?
Thank you, Member Davis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Dr. Burke. The first question I have for you, you mentioned a lot about training and supporting our teachers. The question I have is, who will be doing that?
Well, in Florida,
Dr. Burke.
Okay, thank you. My apologies. Regional coordinators and literacy coaches who will be placed on site in the districts will be responsible for training the teachers, and there will be a trainer model. So our regional coordinators that will be coordinated from the state agency will be responsible for providing that training and then also providing oversight on implementation.
Thank you. I have another question, but
you recognize Ranking Member Davis.
Thank you, Dr. Burke. You mentioned that this program will be funded through the CARES Act dollars and cents, right? So you also mentioned that that's CARES Act money for 2 years. What happens with this program after that 2-year period?
You recognize Dr. Burke.
Thank you. Some of the components that were highlighted as far as the diagnostic assessments and screeners, the regional directors, and then also intense levels of professional development, those are the components that will be funded with CARES Act. After the CARES Act funding goes away, then these particular practices may not be able to be implemented without funding.
Representative Roach, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Doctor, and good morning. The early part of your presentation focused on five components that we use to evaluate implementation on the science of reading. My question is, what data do we have to evaluate those five components, and what are the correct benchmarks we should be looking at?
You recognize Dr. Burke.
All right, so to evaluate the components of reading in the actual classroom, there is not a uniform tool. Of course, within the classroom, within the schools, the administrators are responsible for evaluating instruction, but also the regional directors who will be deployed to those schools are responsible for overseeing implementation. The data that we have now is that our, and I say our because I also believe that I'm part of all of these states, but the data that we have nationally shows that about 60% of Florida's students, fourth grade students, who are not reading proficiently, according to NAEP. So we want to ensure that there are supports and benchmarks in kindergarten, first, second grade, third grade, with universal screeners, common assessments across the board, being able to collect that data, and then also being able to make adjustments to instruction related to that data. And those regional directors and coaches will be on site to assist teachers in making that transition.
Additional question? You recognize Representative Roach.
Thank you, Doctor. And I'm just, I guess to drill down a little bit, what exactly is the data that we're trying to collect? Like how do we measure it?
So the data that you're trying to collect with a universal screener, that which is the initial assessment, the universal screener puts students into two groups. Those students who are at risk for reading difficulty versus those students who are not. You are collecting data such as, you know, phonological awareness. Are the students able to hear the sounds? Are they able to retrieve those sounds automatically? Can they identify their letters? So all of these basic foundational skills. Universal screener would put students into those two groups to identify those who are at risk of reading failure. Then a diagnostic assessment is performed to know exactly where teachers should drill down and where should they start. Should they start with some students on identifying letters? With others, should they start with them on being able to break words into syllables? So these particular components of reading, although they seem to be broad in nature, they have several components with their scope of sequence as far as students being able to learn to read, that universal screener, the diagnostic assessment, and then teachers provide those interventions, and then we assess students again to make sure that those interventions are working. Now, I want to say this. I know I continue to say assess, assess, assess. Many of these assessments, especially the screener, normally takes 10 to 20 minutes to assess students and to see exactly where they are with reading. So the only way we'll know what to do as educators is to know where students are. So that's the data that we are trying to collect.
Thank you.
And Dr. Berg, should states be tracking the data that you're talking about?
Yes, states should definitely be tracking the data. Florida has done this before in previous years, especially with Reading First. There was a common screener that I believe about 95% of the districts were using. This made it a lot more effective and strategic for state education agency leaders, even the regional or literacy coaches, to provide across the board consistent professional development to teachers, and to also be able to collect that data and look at it more broadly across the state. With using universal screeners with different districts across the state, it makes it difficult to compare apples to apples as far as where students are in the early years, kindergarten, pre-K, first grade, second grade. We all know that beginning in third grade, you have your state assessment. And so you can quickly look across the state beginning in third grade to see how students are performing on meeting the standards. But in K-1, 2, and pre-K, there's not a uniform assessment to that degree unless there's a uniform universal screener.
Thank you, Dr. Berg. Representative Hanshofsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Berg, thank you very much for your presentation. I had a comment and a question. So students who have reading challenges, even with the support at home, have a very difficult time, especially when there's a struggle identifying those reading challenges. Students who don't have support at home have even more of a struggle. What can we be doing to make sure that teachers can help identify these students with the reading challenges? And I know you mentioned dyslexia, but there are others, such as auditory processing, that there's very little known about and that often go under the radar, especially when a child is able to compensate on their own. What are some of the things we can be doing to help teachers be on the front lines of identifying these challenges?
Well, I know I sound like a broken, I'm sorry.
Dr. Berg, you're recognized. You're recognized to respond to every question that you get.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm used to having a live audience, so I apologize. So I'll sound like a broken record, but training for teachers, you know, I think we take for granted that our teachers leave or exit their teacher preparation programs knowing all of these things, knowing how to administer diagnostic assessments, having the know-how to know what to do once the diagnostic assessment gives them the data. So ensuring that our teachers have the training to do that, that they know how to identify students with characteristics of dyslexia or other reading challenges, but then also additional supports. I believe that Florida has either passed or are looking to pass legislation regarding reading scholarship accounts. With those reading scholarship or pass the rule. So with those reading scholarship accounts, I believe that parents are able to have tutors. We want to make sure that with that process, I think that tutors are a great resource. We have to make sure with that process, though, that our tutors are trained as well, that our tutors are tutoring students and it's aligned to Florida standards, and that there is a relationship between the tutor and the teacher to ensure that they are in sync with the type of instruction that is being provided, whether it's outside of the classroom with the tutors and then also inside the classroom with the teachers. So I think that ways in which teachers can be supported or families can be supported is to be able to have that additional support. But then also sometimes parents need to just be aware that they need to be aware of the challenges that students, that their children are having early and often, and then other resources that they can use, such as parent read at home plans and the again, access to additional services or supports, whether it's before school or after school, I think would be very beneficial. And of course, additional opportunities for summer learning.
All right, members, we're at 11:30. We're gonna try and end this at 11:35, so we have time for the next presentation. Right now I have Representative Williams, Representative Koster, and Representative McCurdy. Okay, so just keep that in mind. Representative Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Burr, when you spoke about the slide with the different colors, the light blue and the dark blue, you described one of the areas that would not qualify for a certain program. And the way you described them, that they are in a position where they would not qualify for whatever program that you're offering at that point. But I would call that student one that would be struggling. One of students that would not have anybody to guide, encourage, or focus on reading. What happens to that student at that point? Will they be penalized or retained for the third grade, or what do you have in place with this program that will assist them?
Well, for students who are identified with reading deficiencies or reading difficulties, it's best practices, and I believe it is also included in Florida law, that these students have a reading improvement plan. So there is no way that we would say that our students are now identified and we have to just leave it up to the teachers and chance to just provide instruction across the year and not put forth effort to ensure that intensive interventions and intensive supports are provided for those students. Ensuring that those students have what's called a reading improvement plan or individual reading plan to track that progress. This is something that is not for just students with an IEP. This individual reading plan focuses on reading. This can be for general education students and also special education students. But any student, we want to make sure that we catch them early and that we provide those additional supports. And again, mentioning what I did earlier as far as whether it's tutoring, whether it's before or after school supports, whether it's interventions, and then also opportunities for summer learning. So there must be multiple opportunities for students to be successful. Even with the retention piece, students have an opportunity or with guidance from the teachers to submit a portfolio that would indicate the student's progress over time with work products and other types of assessments to ensure that students are on grade level. But then students also have multiple opportunities to show that they are reading on grade level.
Mr. Chair?
Quickly, please.
Okay, you mentioned first grade, third grade. You didn't mention anything about VPK. Is VPK teachers included? And if so, how are they trained?
VPK teachers are trained, from my knowledge, so I'm not going to act like an expert on the VPK efforts, but from my knowledge that they are also or will also be trained by regional directors, regional literacy directors.
Thank you, Dr. Burke. Members, in the interest of time, we're going to move into the next panel. I have Representative Koster and Representative McCurdy. You are first bite at the apple. After this presentation, we'll have a full panel discussion, okay? So thank you, Dr. Burke.
Thank you.
So members, we also have with us faculty from the University of South Florida's Literacy Study Programs to talk about the importance of literacy-rich and home environments, including access to books and how parent-child interactions develop reading skills. Joining us, Dr. Anne-Marie Gunn, who works with vulnerable groups of children and families and has several international publications and conference presentations focusing on culturally responsive literacy practices within teacher education. Dr. Margaret Krause, who works with pre-service teachers in early childhood and elementary settings. Among other things, her research focuses on multimodal literacy practices for children with reading differences. And finally, Dr. Elizabeth Hadley, whose research focuses on supporting vocabulary development in preschool classrooms for children from low-income homes. Among her current projects, she's studying the use of artificial intelligence to develop dynamic language assessments for young children. Dr. Gunn, you are recognized to begin your presentation.
Thank you. I'm going to share my screen. Can everyone see my presentation? Well, thank you for inviting us to present today. My colleagues and I designed this presentation to discuss the importance and impact of book distribution programs. So just a little bit of background information. We are part of the University of South Florida Literacy Studies Hub. And the USF Literacy Studies Hub consists of 10 scholars who research and teach and work around areas of literacy development. Specifically for this presentation, our expertise lie in vocabulary development, science of reading, print-rich environments, dyslexia, culturally responsive teaching practices, and the study and implementation of children's literature.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Gunn. I want to begin just by framing the seriousness of the challenge we face with early literacy. And Dr. Gunn, if you could mute your mic.
I'm afraid that I might lose the presentation.
Getting a big echo.
I'm sorry, Liz. If I do, then I won't be able to show your slides.
I'll just speak with the echo. It'll be great. So you can see the statistic on the screen that only 53% of Florida kindergartners are assessed as academically ready for kindergarten. So even though Florida has provided a number of early educational supports for young children, including BPK, a substantial portion of children still arrive in kindergarten without the academic skills they need to succeed. And we know this because all children in public kindergarten are screened within the first 30 days of school with the Flickers assessment, which is an assessment of early literacy skills. We also know that the problem is even more acute for children growing up in poverty. So nationwide, you can see that 75% of children who are moderate or high income are ready for kindergarten at age 5. Only 59% of those who are closest to the poverty line are ready for kindergarten. And 48% of those below the poverty line have adequate early literacy skills. Stakeholders do a better job of supporting early literacy so that children have a strong foundation for academic success. So first, it's important to understand that early literacy really starts early. So there's evidence that newborns can distinguish their mother's voice from other voices at birth, and children learn about 4 new words a day between the ages of 1 and 5. And children's language and literacy continues to be shaped throughout their infancy and toddlerhood by their family experiences. And in terms of children's neurocognitive development, early childhood really represents this window of opportunity where children's brains are especially receptive to language learning and development. So we have a lot of research, a substantial amount of research, that demonstrates that the home literacy environment predicts children's success in school. So that means, Dr. Gunn, are you okay with that?
Okay.
I see that you're muted. So that means that if children have certain literacy resources in place at home, they're more likely to succeed academically. So the research points to 2 key factors in the home literacy environment. So the first is the literacy-related activities that parents and children engage in. Some examples of these activities are shared book reading, caregiver and child reading books together, caregivers teaching letters and letter sounds, or doing other activities around the prints. The second major factor in the home literacy environment is access to literacy materials. So this includes how many books are in the family home, how frequently the family visits the library, and even access to toys that allow for imaginative play. So children who come from families that have many of these resources do better in school, with 70% of the children with many home literacy resources scoring at national norms in kindergarten versus only 7% of children with fewer home literacy resources. So when we look at all of the factors that contribute to a rich home literacy environment, shared book reading emerges as one of the most important. Shared book reading is really the foundation for children learning to read. It helps children gain familiarity with prints, letters, and letter sounds. It helps children encounter advanced vocabulary words, develop oral language, and understand complex storylines. In a 28-year-long study where children and parents were followed over time, researchers discovered that the amount of time caregivers spent reading to young children predicted their reading achievement and motivation. And this is especially impressive because the researchers controlled for mother's education, which means that this effect was found even in families where the mothers had lower levels of education. So this suggests that reading is a powerful practice for families who come from all different educational backgrounds. So families possess assets like life experiences and cultural resources. It's important to think about these things as we consider how to support children who live in poverty. This means stakeholders need to carefully consider resources that represent communities that are served. In the United States, the National Association for the Education of Young Children recognizes this critical need for culturally and linguistically responsive interventions that support children's skills in ways that build positively on families' beliefs and practices. However, children living in poverty face constraints. We know they have inequitable access to literacy resources. Some of these constraints include things like access to books and other reading materials. When we think about access to books, studies demonstrate that children who are exposed to reading earlier tend to display more advanced language and literacy abilities than children who are read to at an older age. In comparison to children living in poverty, those who have access to more books within the home are more likely to engage in shared storybook reading and to engage themselves with these materials than children whose home provides fewer opportunities. Additional poverty constraints include things like parental time and financial resources and cost of high-quality childcare. So we ask, how can state and local leaders better support early literacy for young children from underserved families? One important way we can better support early literacy is to strengthen the different elements of the literacy ecosystem. This ecosystem is comprised of the home, the school, and the community. If we can strengthen each element of the ecosystem, we potentially build a stronger early literacy learning environment for children. When we talk about strengthening the home early literacy environment, we're talking about things like partnering with parents to support developmentally appropriate active home literacy environments. These are things like shared storybook reading, singing songs to develop phonemic awareness, and ways to have purposeful conversations with children. When we talk about strengthening the school early literacy environment, we're talking about things like providing free public preschool experiences and partnering with schools to provide specialized training in early literacy practices. And when we're talking about the community, we're thinking about how to provide access to books and resources. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the role of book distribution programs.
Just going to unmute myself. So looking at the different research, what are the goals of most book distribution programs? Book distribution programs become increasingly popular in the last few years because of two main reasons. One, the relatively low expense of them, and two, because research has demonstrated that through these different programs, there has been a positive effect on young children. So by the idea is by increasing the number of books in a family's home, you are enhancing their literacy environment by providing more opportunities to talk and have more shared book experiences. So overall, the research demonstrates positive impacts on children's psychological, behavioral, and educational outcomes. And my colleague, Dr. Hadley, will talk a little more about the specific outcomes of these programs in a few slides. So two examples of large-scale book distribution programs are the Dolly Parton Imagination Library and Reach Out and Read. Many people are familiar with Dolly Parton Imagination Library, and the idea behind this program is that from the time a child is born, they can register and receive a book delivered to their home every month until they enter school. This program started in the mid-90s, and they don't provide any other resources. It's just a book delivered to home. And anyone can register for this program, no matter what their socioeconomic status is. And in addition, if you think about this, that means that a child who registers at birth can receive up to 60 books before they start kindergarten. In contrast, Reach Out and Read was started in the late 80s. And this program is partnering with children's pediatric centers. So the idea here is when a family goes for a children's well visit, they receive a book. And so the nurse or a doctor comes and meets with the families. They talk about the importance of book reading and they provide a book to the family. They also provide e-resources and print materials. Now this program does target families from lower socioeconomic statuses, but not exclusively. So the broad picture is here that families that register for this program, they will receive, if they start at birth and go to all their well visits, will receive a total of 10 books by the time the child is the age of 5.
So the question is, are book distribution programs effective? And I'll just begin to talk through this slide as Dr. Gunn is putting it back up. There we go. So there have been a number of research studies that have looked at whether book distribution programs are effective, especially looking at Reach Out and Read and looking at Imagination Library. And luckily for us, just in June, a new meta-analysis came out that addressed this question. So a meta-analysis is a research study that puts all the research available on a topic together to figure out statistically what's the weight of the evidence. And a meta-analysis is really considered like a gold standard for deciding whether or not a program is effective. So this meta-analysis on book distribution programs found that yes, they are effective, both in increasing the quality of the home literacy environment. So parents and children read more together, they had more interest in shared book reading, and they had increased library use. And they're also effective in improving children's literacy skills. So children had increased interest in book reading and increased literacy skills, including both on the decoding side and on the language comprehension side that Dr. Burke spoke about earlier. So most notably, the book distribution programs had about the same impact on vocabulary as an average year of state-funded pre-K. So, and vocabulary is actually a literacy skill that's very hard to improve. So these book distribution programs were very powerful in helping to support some of these early literacy skills. Another study that looked at book distribution programs during the summer for elementary students found that providing books during the summer had the same effect on standardized reading tests as attending summer school. So we think that one reason as to why book distribution programs are so effective is that starting book reading routines early generates a snowball effect. So children learn to love reading and make it part of their daily routine with parents. They read more, so their reading skills are stronger, and they're motivated to continue to read. And it's really important that we get that snowball rolling as early as possible.
Dr. Gunn, in the interest of time, I know a number of our members have questions and everyone on the committee has the material, so I apologize to rush, but I would really like the opportunity to share the last 10 minutes for our members to ask questions of the panel. Is that all right?
Yes. Okay. Would you like me to stop sharing the screen then?
We can go to the full panel so we can see all four of you. I'll begin with Representative Koster.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lupus. So how, you know, in addition to the book distribution programs that you're talking about, how do we reach our parents where they are? What are some effective tools for getting our parents involved in their children's education and reading from an early age?
You're recognized.
Thank you, yes. I think I'll just wait for the rest of you to mute yourself. One important way to reach families and communities is to work through community organizations that are already in place. So some outreach efforts to parents have had success working through VPK, working through Head Start, working through other community organizations. One reason why Reach Out and Read has been successful is that it provides folks at well child checkups, where parents are already there. And sometimes working with doctors, there's some sort of authority there that helps helps promote the use of reading from this sort of reliable, trusted source. So especially with children from low-income families, the challenge is really accessing families, building trust, and working together to promote literacy skills. And so by leveraging these relationships and community organizations that are already present, that can be a really good start for building these networks of parents and teachers and community members who are really invested in supporting children's early literacy.
Representative McCurdy, you're recognized, and I would just ask that you identify the panelists that you would like to answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Dr. Burke. Thank you for the presentation. On the subject of teachers, I was just wondering if we have calculated how this would impact third grade teachers specifically when it comes to evaluations, if more third grade students would be retained or penalized under the program.
I do not.
You're recognized, Dr. Burke.
Thank you. I do not have any information on the calculation for Florida as to how this would impact third grade teachers as far as evaluations are concerned. But I wanted to say that with the components that are in place, with the supports for teachers, with the continuous progress monitoring for students, and identifying what students need and providing those interventions for students, I think that it's just extremely important for all involved, including the administrator, including, you know, those who will be evaluating and providing support, to just be a part of the process along the way. So when you're thinking about interventions, it's our evaluations, it really just comes down to ensuring that our teachers are implementing the components, adjusting their instruction to meet the needs of students, and then also that support is being provided.
Representative Hawkins, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First part of my question will be directed to Dr. Hadley. Do we see a difference, or has it been looked at, when a child receives a hardbound book or receiving it electronically and using an iPad or something like that? Is there a difference in their excitement to use that or more willingness to do that?
You recognize Dr. Hadley.
That's a fantastic question. To my knowledge, there hasn't been research on that specific area, but there is research that shows that children's engagement with ebooks is as high as it is with hardback or print books, typically, and that for some children, having access to electronic books can even help support differences in reading abilities. For example, children can highlight a word and get a definition. There's certain kinds of print that can be easier to read for children with learning differences. And of course, access is so much better with electronic books that I think that's a really exciting future area to explore, the use of distributing electronic books in addition to or instead of print books.
Thank you, and I think there's a cost savings also that we probably could see down the road. Dr. Burke, last part of my question. In my private sector position, I oversee a program called Bookmark Buddies, where prior to COVID, we have seniors and volunteers go in and read with third graders that have been deemed struggling. Could you see a program like that if it was being able to made virtually, helping out? Because as Representative Koster said, getting the parents involved these days, and nothing against parents, but everybody seems to be busy, but having volunteers that want to help students is a big way to do that. If we could get that program virtually, if you're aware of that program, I'd love to hear it. And you can follow up with me directly for time.
Dr. Burke, you're recognized for a quick response.
Yes, I'm not aware of that program, but I think that there are other, there's a great opportunity for that to be effective. There are schools that have partnered with university teacher prep programs to do similar things. So I think that's the Bookmark Buddies. I think that's a really good idea.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
And I follow up later.
Thank you, Representative Hawkins. And Ranking Member Davis, you are recognized for the final question today.
Thank you, Chair. Just on page 9, and I think this was for Dr. Burke. On page 9, slide 9, actually, I was just wanting to ask, what does the adopt a comprehensive third grade reading policy look like? And that's the
question. You're recognized.
Okay, thank you. Adopting the comprehensive policy is what Florida has already done. The implementation piece and the different components, that's the part that we have to make sure that we continue to recommit to those best practices and those pieces. So the comprehensive policy includes ensuring students are reading by the end of third grade, by implementing universal screeners, interventions, professional development, parent communication, and those things. And I do want to make a clarification about VPK, if I can. The VPK teachers take a 5-hour course through the Florida Center for Reading Research. And if they are at one of the schools identified for having literacy coaches, one of the public schools, then they do have access to the regional director. Other VPK agencies have access to a regional facilitator who provides support to those teachers. So I wanted to make sure that I clarified that for the record.
Thank you, Dr. Burke. So members, please join me in thanking our panelists who were with us today. We appreciate you for taking the time to have this important discussion. Clearly, an hour is not enough time. I realize in my previous committees, an hour is never enough time for these issues that speak to the future of Florida, but I truly appreciate the engagement from the members, and we will make sure that the contact information of the panelists is available should you have questions following. Before we stop, I have 120 seconds, and I'm going to use all of them. I just want to introduce the incredible Kirsten Olson and the indefatigable Adam Brink. Kirsten is the administrative assistant, and she's been with the Education and Employment Committee for 3 years, and also she's the assistant for the Higher Education and Lifelong Learning Subcommittee. And Adam Brink is our policy chief, an incredible friend, somebody I've had the opportunity to work with for the last 2 years very closely, and this is his 9th legislative session. He began in the process when he was 11, so we're really excited about him. Members, just to recap briefly, today we've learned that many students who struggle to read do not receive the instruction that meet their needs. Although Florida has been on the forefront of reading instruction policy, there is still much to be done to ensure that our teachers have the training and resources necessary to teach reading in a way that is effective for all students. In addition, our focus must also be on finding meaningful ways to support the development of literacy skills and the building of word-rich environments in the home. Families across the state could benefit from programs like we discussed today that put books in the hands of students and support parents in fostering even more reading engagement with their children. The more teachers and parents are able to teach and support reading, the better Florida can recover lost learning and help students read at grade level. See, members, I want you to understand the line that we can draw from kindergarten readiness to third grade reading to high school graduation is very straight and it is very clear. So these issues are truly about the future of Florida, and I look forward to working with each and every one of you over the next session to ensure that the future is bright for all of our students. And with that, Ranking Member Davis moves that we rise.